Welcome to the Center Church Podcast. This is Kate and Jeremy, and this week we are in Ecclesiastes, starting out chapter 11. We'll be covering verses 1 through 6.
Do you want to tell them what the title of this episode is? Well, I mean, there was some debate. That's why I brought it up.
We're calling this one, Do It Anyway.
Or... Sorting through uncertainty. I don't know. I'll just do it anyway. What is that? So I'll read chapter 11, verses 1 through 6. Send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time you will find it. Give a share to 7 and even to 8, for you know not what evil will be on earth. If the clouds fill, they will empty out rain on the earth. And if a tree falls in the south or the north, the place where the tree falls, there it will be. He who watches the wind will not plant, and he who gazes on clouds will not harvest. As you know not the path of the life breath into the limbs within the full womb, so you know not the deeds of God. Who does everything? In the morning plant your seed, and at evening let your hand not rest. For you know not which will be fit, this one or that, or whether both will be equally good. Okay, so.
Now read it again in a Matthew McConaughey voice.
Like, God.
These.
We're going to start releasing two podcasts. Separately. Every commentary I read on this, and so there's some philosophy written about it, send out your bread upon the waters for the long course of time, for in the long course of time you will find it. Send out your bread upon the waters. This is a famous kind of axiom. Did you know that?
I read that, and I was surprised as well, because I have only ever heard it in the Bible. I've never heard anyone else say that.
One author, you know, you would think this is attributed to Benjamin Franklin, but in fact, it is the teacher. And I wasn't aware it was Benjamin Franklin ever. Apparently, though, this is a well-known didactic metaphor. This instructive kind of teaching, but it's also surprisingly not very easy to make much sense of. So I think, so Kate and I have done this, I think mainly because it's just kind of worked out this way. You have only maybe kind of a general idea of what I'm going to be talking about. I really don't know your points. And so we'll just kind of trade off. And in this case, I'll be going first because I do know that I'll be covering some content at the beginning, and then you'll have some things to say about some middle verses, and I'll probably conclude.
Yeah, so, I like to keep the excitement alive in our marriage.
The surprise, yeah. So this first two verses, these first two verses, send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time you will find it. Give a share to 7 and even to 8, for you know not what evil will be on earth. So apparently there's quite a lot of commentary on these verses. And there's really, it all organizes into maybe four ways of interpreting this metaphor. I'm not going to go through all four of those. There are two that seem to be valid, particularly valid, and so we're going to take a look at those for a minute and then draw some insight from those. So Rashi and Ibn Ezra both read this reference, this idea of casting, or rather, excuse me, not casting, but sending out your bread upon the waters, as a reference to acting charitably. So this, they interpret this as an act of charity, and that would be nice. And I think there's something to that, but I don't know that that's fully the case. On the other hand, you have Tremper Longman, who takes another tack, and he basically reads this as the diversification of investment. So to act as wisely as possible in uncertain times, to navigate uncertain times, you want to send your bread upon the waters, giving a share to seven or even, and even to eight, for you know not what evil will be on the earth. In other words, Longman basically says this is about how to be a good steward and wisely handle your resources. So you want to diversify whatever your resources are. We all have different portfolios. We all have different resources of different kinds, right? There's more than even, you know, financial resources. But whatever those resources are, diversify them. Don't put all your eggs in one basket is I think what Longman makes of this text. I think that actually, at risk of running maybe a middle ground fallacy, I think that Fox's reading is best, and there's some synthesis in Fox's interpretation between more ancient interpretations, which are about charity, and Longman, which has to do with diversification. So Fox says this: wager on charitable and gracious deeds. Wager on charitable and gracious deeds, even if this seems like a long shot. Take chances, but spread the risk around. I think this has some useful support because there's other ancient wisdom literature that is similar, and these echo one another. So one ancient Egyptian wisdom text reads this: do a good deed and throw it in the water. When it dries up, you will find it. Basically, do something good and don't think about it again. So do good, engage in charity, be diverse in the ways in which you're charitable, take risks in the ways in which you're in the ways in which you're charitable. But when you do good, don't think about it again. Don't wait for the payoff. Ben Sira offers another wisdom teaching that is similar. Lose your money for the sake of a brother or a friend. Lose your money for the sake of a brother or a friend. Ptahotep, the ancient Egyptian wisdom teacher and political leader, ruler, says this: the exact reason one should be generous with one's wealth is because one doesn't know what the future will bring. The exact reason one should be generous with one's wealth is because one doesn't know what the future will bring. And so I think that Fox is onto something because it resonates throughout other ancient wisdom literatures that are of the same era, same time period. And I think that it's interesting to note what is going on here, because there's some really fascinating things happening in these two verses, and hopefully that lays maybe a little bit of the groundwork for this. Essentially, what we see happening is, and what is encouraged is that we should adopt a posture of uncalculating generosity. And this text suggests that this is a sign of wisdom. So those of you who if you're, you know, in a small group or in discussion later, this is kind of the first observation I have, which is that we should adopt a posture of uncalculating generosity. And to do that is a sign of wisdom. So, and I think that's actually very, really counterintuitive. I mean, it's not... Colette is not the only person to say this. I mean, we've just looked at a few others that are saying very similar kinds of things, but it's really in many ways quite counterintuitive. So, and it's embedded in some of the Hebrew in the text. So I really, the language of sending as opposed to something like casting is worth noting. And it's actually rather convicting imagery here. Send your bread upon the waters is not... not remotely goal-directed. This is the idea that we should be generous, we should be charitable and gracious in a way that is not, in a way that's not calculating, anticipating what we'll get back, in a way that is not even strategic, in the sense that, you know, I mean, we want to be strategic about, like, our generosity and our giving. I understand that, right? So we want to give to charities that are are good charities. We want to give to charities that make sure the large portion of what we give gets to the people who need the money or the resources. We want to give our time and energy in ways that are conscientious and effective. So I'm not arguing against doing research, but and understanding the kind of charity that we should do. But the imagery here of sending out your bread upon the water, this non-goal-directed kind of generosity, evokes imagery of kneeling down and letting go of something that carries real value to you, which of course can be money, but it's also time and many other things as well. There's this notion of like kneeling down, letting go, and seeing the thing float away on the surface of the water, and the release in that. That kind of generosity, that kind of posture of giving and being charitable and expecting nothing in return, I think that the idea that posture, that's the exact posture we should adopt when we don't know what the future will bring, is really probably very counterintuitive and certainly kind of counter. What maybe common wisdom would be. You would think that if you don't know what the future would bring, you're going to want to, like, store up your resources. And interestingly, also, like, in ancient wisdom literature, and Ecclesiastes is no different, there is this idea that, like, if you do good, eventually somehow good comes back to you. But that needs all kinds of... We have to elaborate on that a little bit, because the idea is that if you do good, good comes back to you is not, like, if I write this check... You know, it's not the televangelist where it's like, if I write this check, then, you know, I'm going to get two times the amount next month. That's exactly the opposite of what's being said here. What's being said here is if you release what the resources you have as this act of if you're doing this in an ongoing way, this posture of generosity, you can expect ultimately that you will be doing God's work. You can expect that ultimately, like, it will benefit you because it will make you, it's part of making you the person that God would have you be. But it's not this kind of one for one.
I think important to note in the direction that you're taking here is that the language used is not let it go and it will definitely come back to you. It's let it go and it may come back. But there isn't any certainty there, and this whole verse, all the verses that we're talking about today, the overriding idea is one of uncertainty, and so it really plays into that. But I take it you lean more into this verse is about charity than this verse is about diversifying your your business investments.
I don't know. I was curious, even as I was like, trying to think through how, so, I mean, I don't know, how would we even know, right? There's other ancient wisdom literature that, again, that seems to also dial in particularly on charity as a central kind of value. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's what's being taught in verses 1 and 2. However, I tend to be comfortable with kind of either or.
The ambiguity.
Well, I shouldn't say either or. I mean to say rather, I think this can be saying more than one thing, right? And I think that when you see ambiguity, that may be an indicator that probably we're dealing with some kind of metaphor or axiom that is deep enough that it probably has layers of kind of application. The thing that I see, I do see diversification in this, though, right? Like, how do you get away from that? Like, give a share to 7 or even to 8, you know, for you, for you know not what evil will be on earth. You can certainly read that as diversify your resources. But I find it very interesting to read that as be generous broadly, because actually generosity is the best response. It is the wise response to an uncertain future. So I don't know, what did you make of that?
To me, I tend to land more in the livelihood camp over the, of course, I think out of your livelihood comes your generosity. So, you know, it could, like you said, be able to communicate more than one idea at once. But I do tend to think he's talking about money, wealth, that sort of thing. That tends to build on what he's already talked about in previous chapters and kind of the cast of his mind a little bit, which may be reading more into a person I've never met than is appropriate.
When we
of
even
course.
Think it's a one person, you know, yeah. There are many, many things there, right?
The mysterious Q. But I do like the way that you pointed out the language here is let it go. Let it go.
Right.
And in the future, it may come back in some format. Also, there's the idea that because it may, it also may not.
Right.
Let it go.
Right, which doesn't feel like diversification of
The second one feels like diversification. For me, the first one is do the thing. You know, make the investment, start the business. And then the second verse is, but when you do start the business, don't put all of your, you know, don't put all of your eggs in one basket, because you could drop the basket. So diversify a little bit. So it does seem to me like perhaps some ancient wisdom about how to conduct your resource, how to take care of your
resources. But again, and I'm not trying to beat this into the ground or even debate it, but like I think we're actually probably so far as I get a little like mind on this. But I mean, it seems to me that the person who has the posture of, okay, I'm going to take some business, some risks in my business venture may also be the person who lets it go, who sends the bread upon the water when it comes to their charity as well. And I think that's what we, you know, I think that's the kind of counterintuitive component to this wisdom. You know, if somebody says, you know, you need to diversify, like, yeah, I mean, yes, agreed. Like, that may be kind of common wisdom and somewhat obvious, yes. But the idea that, like, if you are charitable and that's your posture, this, like, letting go of resource, you're not holding on to resources too tightly, that same kind of charitable heart, I think, affects how we think about, you know, it affects how we think about wealth and other aspects of our life. So the person who's willing to do that is also probably the person who's more willing to take risk in business. They may have a healthier relationship to their resources, I guess is what I'm saying.
And a healthier relationship to uncertainty.
Right.
Because they're not gripping any idea of security too tightly. Because they know in a moment it could be gone.
Right. Yeah, it's so this is where so if the future is uncertain, right, the more uncertainty that is present in one, you know, in one's life, future or I guess present, right? The more uncertainty that is there, I think the more valuable relationships are, the more valuable community is, and I think in part that's built on generosity. And I think that's where we get into some really tricky stuff. And I was thinking about various things you might say in response to this, but like, you know, it strikes me as on one level you can say, okay, so it's very manipulative. Say, okay, I'm going to be generous to these people, generous with time, generous with money, generous with whatever. I'm going to be generous with these people, knowing that my generosity is going to lead to endearment. And I think that that can be manipulative. I think that can... So I don't know that that's really what's being suggested here. What I see being suggested here is this just kind of awareness of the way the world works. You know that when you develop relationships with people that are meaningful, it's going to come at cost. You're going to be generous to people. You're going to be charitable to people in your life. And you also know that there's advantage to that. You know that they will be good to you. And, like, this isn't something that – I don't think it's evil to, like, be aware that, that's one way we develop relationships. I mean, it's people helping each other, taking care of each other. It's the way a community functions. So I think that sometimes we're reactionary to, like, even understanding that, you know what, me being good to you will result in probably you helping me if I need it. Like, there's nothing in the world wrong with that, and it doesn't make you manipulative or calculating to understand that that's, in fact, how relationships work.
There is this idea of social credit embedded within us that we may not even be keeping track, that there may not be that active calculation going on. If I help this person out, then when it's their turn to help me, they'll definitely feel obligated to do it. But I do think that that may be what you're talking about here. That's
exactly right. And I think that the thing is that I think where you really go into, like, places of unhealth, which I think the text is speaking against, even if not directly, I think the places that become problematic are when you're doing something for someone, you're engaging in charity, right? It violates, like, the very principle of what charity is, right? Like, we're no longer talking about charity when after being charitable, your response is, okay, so when am I going to get what I deserve?
Yes, it's
like we've left, yeah. At that point, we've left charity behind. This is just understanding that by having this posture, by sending out the bread upon the waters, like, it probably is going to be better for you than worse.
It's the social contract that we all live under, and it's one of the reasons why people live together in groups for safety, for security, for caretaking, and you don't want to find yourself in a position of being the one who is always the taker. Because that person is really unpopular in any communities once the stress hits.
Right.
And once the crisis hits, that person becomes more of a burden than anything else. It's all about this idea of, like, giving as much as you take in terms of being a community member, this civic responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, you said it earlier, and I think that it is... I think it cuts to the center of these first two verses, which is basically that, again, you know, sending out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time, send out your bread upon the waters, for in the long course of time, you will find it. Like, the long course of time. This is not a passage about immediate reciprocity or getting what you deserve or ledgers, you know, you owe me this and I owe you that. It is antithetical to that. The long course of time is this idea that in over the arc of your life, the good you do is ultimately better for you too. And it's funny, I mean, I just don't know that I'm glad we spent the time on this, but ideally, like, this would be so embedded into Christian culture and ethos that it would be just too obvious to even say. But there really is still, I mean, for, and again, I mean, we are probably, our default position may not be correctly aligned here, but, you know, there's still this kind of intuition, right? Which is, yeah, but, like, they never really gave me anything back for that. You know, I'm always the one that's giving in this circumstance, relationship, in this interaction. Like, I'm never, you know, I'm always waiting on the payoff, and I just don't know that that's, you know, I don't know that that leads to that kind of long-term health and growth that I think wisdom would suggest we want to lean into.
Well, and I wonder too if the idea of the reward that a lot of people expect for their good behavior is really recognizable in terms of a life well lived as a person of integrity in your community.
Right. That simple, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe those are caricatures. I don't know that I can even say that it's hard. I'm not even sure that I actually could name anyone that I know that's like, yeah, no, I'm waiting on the check to come in. you know, because I gave last month. I'm waiting on that check to come in. So anyway, this may be more, this may be less about specific individuals who count on those kinds of things, at least within kind of Christianity, evangelical Christianity, whatever, and maybe more about just kind of an internal disposition that we, you know, we're all kind of, we may battle that intuition. When is this going to pay off for me? And I think, so maybe that's really more where this registers. Don't wait on that. Adopt a posture of uncalculating generosity. Anyway, those are some observations on 1 and 2. Kate, what do you have for verses 3, 4, and 4?
All right, so 3 and 4. If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will lie.
No commentary needed.
So the two general themes covered here are the ideas of inevitability and randomness. Humans do not control what happens. Specifically in this context that he's talking about agriculturally, but I think generally we don't control what happens, and we can't predict or change an outcome at all. So digging in a little bit to the examples that he gives here, we can say that there are agriculturalists who are waiting for the ideal or perfect weather conditions to plant or to sow. They will never plant or sow anything because it won't happen. They're not going to have these perfect or ideal conditions, and by the time they realize that they were perfect, it's too late. So if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. If the clouds are full of rain and you're just looking for that, you're going to miss your opportunity. If you're too worried to sow your seeds that the wind will blow them away, or too worried to reap your crops that a storm will occur and ruin it, you will be paralyzed in inaction.
But are you going to deal with that tautology?
Well, if I do, then I do.
Oh my gosh. Where the tree falls, there it will be. You know, but literary tautologies have their place.
Apparently here.
What do we have? To be or not to be? That is the question. There's one. Continue.
So trying in your life to plan so precisely with too much detail and certainty about the future will prevent any action at all, because these things are unknowable and there's just too many variables to account for. So you'll overwhelm yourself trying to account for all of them, or you'll miss your opportunity because you don't realize what to you was the perfect time where all your criteria was met. You don't realize until it's already passed and you can't jump on it. So Colette urges action, not inactivity. That's something that reading through this entire book and we've mentioned every time, like, he is not a fan of inactivity. He's not a fan of not working.
Yeah, I think he's misread to, I think Colette is misread to sometimes, there's a fatalism that is read into Ecclesiastes that I think is just kind of misunderstood. Yeah, there are deterministic factors. There's this kind of deterministic outcome, this causal relationship that God has to the universe. Things are set into motion, right? Like, a tree falls, and there is where the tree will be because that's how it works. Rain clouds gather and they empty rain onto the earth. So I think sometimes those kind of deterministic observations about the universe end up being like causing people to misread Colette. He is for action and for seizing the day, right?
He is for doing it anyway.
Oh my do it. He wants us to sort through uncertainty. That's what he wants.
Anyway, his advice is to go ahead and act anyway, even if we can't know the outcome, even in risk, do it anyway. As we're moving on to verse 5, the way that the spirit comes to the bones in the womb of a woman with child, so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. In the best way possible, we are ignorant of God's plans. The how and the why are just beyond us. This is already been stated in Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 11, chapter 8, verse 17, chapter 9, verse 12, many other places. We are unable to know God's activity here on earth because we cannot know what will happen. We can prepare for different outcomes and be ready to act. That is wisdom in recognizing and accepting and letting go of the idea that we need to know, accepting the idea that we don't know, and moving forward anyway. So this may bring some comfort to those listening who are risk averse and have experienced the disappointment of a risky move not turning out in their favor. But he also says that since we don't know the seed we planted in the morning, again using more of this agrarian language, will germinate and produce enough food, we'd better plant twice with the hope that one or both will grow. And this isn't, it's this idea of hedging your bets a little bit, but more it just seems like a wise decision. You don't know how it's going to turn out, so invest early.
Yeah, and I think that this gets to some of your commentary earlier as well, but action or inaction includes this implicit risk, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's part of, as I was listening to your observations on verses 4 and 5, I mean, you know, there's risk, whether or not you choose to harvest, whether or not you choose to plant, whether or not your head is in the clouds and you're waiting for the exact right moment or not, not acting is risk. So there's this, I think, cognitive bias that makes us think that standing still is less risky. It isn't. That's not true. I mean, it's not the case. There's risk whether you make whether you take the action or not. Right. And I think that that gets into like kind of why, what motivates us to move.
I think so. And you've probably heard people say before, inaction is action. Because right. Failing to take action still has an outcome. And this advice is to take the risk, but take it well.
And there's also a critique here of how knowledge does not protect us against fear, and how knowledge does not incline us to take more risks necessarily. I mean, you know, so we don't even know the path of life breath into the limbs. We don't know the deeds of God. And sometimes those who most desire to know those things, as soon as I've accounted for every variable, then I can make a move. We know that that's ultimately not wise. There is some wisdom in thinking through a thing, but the idea of taking control in that way is in part, I think, what those lines are speaking against. But
and to take a risk well sometimes looks from the outside like you're not taking a risk because you're weighing all of your options and you're seeing all the possible outcomes and you're planning and it's intentional and it's thought through.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is a risk because even the best plan sometimes doesn't turn out the way you want. You can do everything right and you still don't know.
Yeah.
It's reminiscent of other parts of the Bible, like Proverbs 27 and some other parts where it says, don't boast about what you're going to do tomorrow, but know that it's God willing this will happen.
Also, when I hear that, I hear you kind of critiquing the idea that, well, you know, I'm taking a risk because I am leaving the country.
Right.
You know, I'm taking a risk because I quit that, you know, I quit that job.
And I didn't have anything else lined up.
You know, and it's really touch and go what I'll do next. I mean, I think those are caricatures to be on the ground a little bit more, you know, like, maybe we should do that. But, like, I think those are caricatures of what is real risk. The way a wise person would approach risk, which is certainly not to measure it by how crazy the outcome mm-hmm. is going to be. That's not at all what it is to send your bread out upon the waters. I mean, that's such a different kind of thing.
But I would like to touch on this idea of inaction that we discussed a little bit earlier, because I think when you're choosing whether or not to act and you can't make a decision, sometimes you can feel paralyzed in your indecision or paralyzed in inaction. But sometimes there really truly is an overwhelming amount of things that can go wrong. Sometimes there's a number of things that can go right, and you truly do not feel empowered to move forward. But what we can do is map out what we know and be fully aware of the amount of uncertainty in which we all operate. Our context as human beings is uncertainty, but because we're so uncomfortable with it, we don't like to acknowledge it. And we like to think more about the things that we are controlling and have this illusion of control. But if you're willing to map out uncertainty, you can narrow the space in which you're trying to make a decision, because within that space of uncertainty, that's where you're exercising intuition, which is a combination of experience, knowledge, and wisdom. Sappho talks about a cone of uncertainty. This is Paul Sappho, not the Sappho.
Oh, yeah, I was...
I know you were thinking of...
Right.
The lyrical poet.
Right, yeah. The I was running through the Rolodex of the many...
You were getting your liar prepared.
Mr. and Ms. Sapphos that I know. Yeah, right.
So Paul Sappho, who's a pretty well-known forecaster, he talks about this cone of uncertainty, which is just his term for the space in which all possibilities inhabit. So we can't list all of the possible things that could happen to us. Nobody could. But we can kind of group them into categories. So he talks about the highly possible and the wildly improbable. So for example, that your plan is to buy a house in the next couple months, you can make the plan for the future by starting with the highly probable. Okay, so within that midline in your cone of uncertainty, the loan is approved, the inspection finds nothing of importance, the closing goes smoothly, and you've got yourself a house. So then, next you can talk about the less likely but still possible scenarios, things that you know do happen to people. The loan isn't approved, or there's termites, something falls through. And then you can move on to the things you only hear about once in a while, like suddenly you lose your job in the middle of the process, or the house burns down, or move on, and the cone widens, and you're talking about the economy collapsing, or the government has to bail out the banks. All of these things have happened, but they're not as probable as just the normal mundane stuff. And Sappho's personal favorite is the evidence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe is discovered. That's the one that he likes to throw in, that would really throw a wrench in your plans. Mm. So the possibilities vary from what is really commonplace and therefore mundane to us, and then to those things that have never happened before and are therefore barely imaginable, and that would mark a turning point in, like, the history of our species. So I know it's like an odd exercise, but it reminds me of what Colette talks about here, which is make an intentional and well-thought-out plan. Plant twice to harvest once. Plant. Life has to move forward no matter what, no matter of our ignorance of the future. But the important thing is, Sappho calls these, like, unlikely and hugely important occurrences the wild cards. And they're few enough and far between that we just don't see them coming, even when we're warned about them. We don't believe they're so unimaginable that we don't believe they could ever happen. So, like, 9/11 would be a prime example of this. We were warned, but nobody who was warned thought that something that big could happen, that life-changing. But once they do happen, we begin to see them everywhere. And so it's important to be careful, especially because right now we're currently experiencing a wild card event in the economic issues that we're having because of the pandemic. Like, this is an event that will happen, I would hope, once in all of our lifetimes. And so because we're experiencing a wild card event now, we are primed to see them everywhere. And so you may find yourself experiencing that right now, where we're in the middle of a thing that you never thought would happen, so now all the other things that you never thought would happen are haunting you, and all your decision-making skills and all of your ability to, like, choose and plan for the future has been paralyzed. So if all you can imagine are those wild cards, the outliers, it become your future planning in your mind becomes so cluttered with events that are so unlikely to occur, but also horrifying, that you become distracted by them and you're missing the mundane, commonplace, even certain things coming your way. So a godly attitude, I think, and what is prescribed by Colette is to be aware of the uncertainty of the future, to make a good, solid plan based on what you're certain is coming your way, what might come your way. And sure, go ahead and plan for, like, having a relationship with an extraterrestrial, like, society that's intelligent, like, if you want to, put that in your plan. But rest and abide in Christ and the peace and confidence that God loves you and he cares what happens to you. And you are not alone and you are not abandoned by him.
Yeah, that I think it connects perfectly for with the kind of final observation I have, which really has to do with whatever those why. And so, you know, for our Center Church community, you are all in such different places in the way you've experienced the last many months. Whatever your wild card events are looking like, whatever has been brought into your life over the last many months, and those things, the things that have been brought in, have varied. I would just encourage you. I would implore you to subvert those wild card events, to subvert the variables and the temporary conditions that you're facing and experiencing. Subvert those things to who God is and what God's nature is. So I'm not saying that you ignore the moments of anxiety. By the way, some of you have had very little anxiety or stress surrounding the last many months, but that's not to say that you don't have anxieties and stressors. I mean, they come in many forms. Whatever they are, I would just encourage you to subvert them. Put them, like, allow them to, you know, as they come into your mind and heart, like, give them their hearing, right? Like, okay, you're gonna have this moment of anxiety or stress or uncertainty, and allow it to pass before you. But put all of that underneath the much brighter truth of who God is and what his nature is. And I see that in verse 6 as well. In the morning, plant your seed, and at evening, let your hand not rest. How do we do that? How do we recognize who God is and what his nature is? Well, the answer is there are many ways to celebrate and glorify God, to recognize who God is and what his nature is. And one of them is to pursue the work you believe in, pursue the work you know needs to be done, because it's your responsibility to do that. And if you allow the circumstances that you're in, the wild card events, to shut you down, to take ownership of your life, then, and we're not, you know, and this is not, I'm not talking about heaven or hell, we're not talking about, like, you know, then you're really in trouble, then you don't. No, this is about you communing with God. It's about you, as Kate said, abiding in Christ. If we allow those kinds of events to overshadow the nature of who God is and to glorify him through important work, you know, in the morning plant your seed, and at evening let your hand not rest. If we allow circumstance to dictate the important work that we are responsible for doing that's been put before us, then it actually is going to ultimately damage us and diminish us. And to pursue that work, to pursue the opportunities, the work that needs to be done right in front of us, is, I think, a way of glorifying God. So there is a Tarkovsky quote when he was talking about the making of Andrei Rublev that resonated with me. This is from his book Sculpting in Time. The only condition of fighting for the right to create is faith in your own vocation, readiness to serve, and refusal to compromise. The only condition of fighting for the right to create is faith in your own vocation, readiness to serve, and refusal to compromise. Artistic creation demands of the artist that he perish utterly in the full, tragic sense of those words. And so, if art carries with it a hieroglyphic of absolute truth, this will always be an image of the world made manifest in the work once and for all time. It goes on. And by the way, it's interesting in that, like, interesting anyway, that of all films that he made to be referencing, it's Andrei Rublev. I mean, which is very much thematically connected to Ecclesiastes as well. I'm now thinking of other films that are thematically connected to Ecclesiastes. I have to say this now, a serious man. So if you've not watched that film, the thematic connections to Ecclesiastes are multitudinous. The point that I want to make around the Tarkovsky quote is that, you know, we use language, you know, Kate and I use this language. I bet many of you are also use this kind of language. Okay, well, what is it to abide in Christ? I mean, these are it's not really Christianese, but they're just very thick terms. Like, what do we do with that? Well, look, one of the things you can do with that is understand that when you pursue your vocation, when you pursue work that needs to be done, if you believe that work has been placed in front of you, the needs that you're fulfilling have been placed in front of you as a part of God's plan, pursuing those vocations, those things that have been put on your, like, heart, that are part of, like, the very fabric of who you are, that is a way of experiencing Christ present. And I think, to go back to Kate's commentary, like, wild card events can often cause us to push those things away because we're trying to just kind of, like, protect ourselves and protect our families and shore up all of, but in fact, the opposite needs to be happening. We need to be sending our bread out upon the waters and being generous and charitable and doing good because we do those things through the important work that's before us. So I have to touch on this, and we can close with this. You will always be afraid. You'll always be waiting for the other shoe to drop. Whether that is something that is as cataclysmic as a pandemic, or whether that is the career that you're pursuing that you're not sure is going to work out, you're always going to be waiting for the other shoe to drop. And even then, when you have success, you're not going to really enjoy it. You're not going to be able to rest in it and celebrate it in a way that is right, in a way that's good, because that's the only success you're going to have, and the rest is going to be failure. We're always waiting for things to fall apart if we have wrong-headed notions of who God is. And I, without reading all of Matthew, the parable in Matthew 25, the parable of the talents, I want to just remind you of the parable. We have this master or lord that leaves, and he leaves these servants who are responsible for managing portions of his wealth. One servant trades 5 talents and is able to gain 5 talents more. His master returns and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Another servant takes 2 talents and is able to turn that into 4. And as you know, the final servant, afraid of losing the money of his master, the final servant saves the talent and does nothing with it. Why does the final servant make nothing of what he's given? "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." The only person that is keeping track of what might be lost is the servant who holds on to the 1 talent that he was given. Look at how these characters are depicted and what this tells us about who God is and this sort of generosity and charity you need to pursue in the work that you do. This is a master who is just giving his servants his wealth, seemingly with like quite a bit of abandon. He even says to the last servant, even if you'd invested it in a bank that gives very little interest in return, that would have been something. So Robert Farrar Capon, he says this in his observation on this parable. The only bookkeeper in the parable is the servant who decided he had to fear a non-existent audit and who therefore hid his one talent in the ground. The sheer, and then he highlights a central theme of the parable, the sheer needlessness of fear, the utter non-necessity of our ever having to dread God, the servant with his little shovel and his mousy apprehension that God is as small as himself, he is just one more of the pitiful turkeys that Jesus parades through his parables to shock us, if possible, into recognizing the stupidity of unfaith. The elder brother, the man without the wedding garment, the laborers who worked all day, the Pharisee who tried to wheedle God into thinking he was a good egg, all of these are cardboard figures, cartoon characters designed to elicit only a smile at the preposterousness of their behavior. It is also true, of course, that they are the figures we most easily identify with. But then that is because we are just as preposterous. We spend our lives invoking upon ourselves imagined necessities, creating God in the image of our own fears. And all the while, he is beating us over the head with the balloon of grace and the styrofoam baseball bat of a vindicating judgment. The history of salvation is slapstick all the way, right up to and including the end. This line, we spend our lives invoking upon ourselves imagined necessities, creating God in the image of our own fears. If you want to pursue the work that you believe needs to be done, if you want to be charitable, if you want to be gracious, if you want to resist and transcend even wild card events that certainly run the risk of filling us with anxiety and fear, you have to view God the right way. He's not waiting to get you. He's with you. And you can experience that abiding by doing the very work that he's put in front of you and by sorting through the uncertainty that comes. Okay, do you notice I worked in the title that I preferred to the end of it?
So we'll close out with a meditation for you. Lord, may we let go. May we let go of certainty and embrace your sovereignty. May we let go of fear. May we let go of anxiety. May we let go of needing to know. Fill us with you, who you are and your nature, your love and your care. Fill our hearts with the brightness of your truth. Let it go from us to others. Let us pursue the work you've given us in our communities, our families, and ourselves. Abide in us. We abide in you.